perhaps not. I assume that the clearing of the courtroom is not a reflection on either your reputation or a belief about the upcoming argument. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. David Epstein for the appellant. With me is Alon Stein. Your Honors, this is a much more of a garden variety and common law case than you have been hearing this morning. The precedental value of your decision in this case, however, is very likely to spell out what plaintiffs may do to prove an investment fraud case in this circuit. This case, which was tried to a jury, was a common law fraud case. It is important to note that this case was not a breach of fiduciary duty case, although we submit it was in fact treated that way by the plaintiff's evidence and by the plaintiff's arguments and indeed ultimately by the jury incorrectly. This case was about two distinct and unrelated investments that the Kapelanskis chose to make, one of which was through my client, Scott Johnson, which was the purchase of ATM machines, which I emphasize is the acquisition of a business rather than the acquisition of a passive investment instrument or a commodity which one simply holds in order to resell. This was the purchase of ATM machines, the purchase of a piece of equipment which needs to be placed in service, managed, operated, repaired, and everything else in order to make money. It is a business. It is a legitimate business. It is a business that even has its own trade organization.
Is ATM one business, or is it all one business?
Well, it's one business. There were, in this case, a group of ATMs which were in place in the field in various locations, and I would emphasize none of which were in Chicago. This was an investment to purchase and operate ATMs which were scattered around the country in other states in various locations. But what happened here was the second investment, which was an investment in an offshore trading program, which is fairly undescribed in this record and was undescribed substantially to the Kapelanskis, was not Mr. Johnson's investment. That was an investment that was first of all, was not even recommended by Mr. Johnson, which is one of the core defects in this record, in the liability on this record. Because what the jury came back with was $100,000 of verdict on actual damages. And the only way, rationally, to come to a $100,000 verdict, given the evidence and given the way the case was argued, given the damages argument in the case, was on the offshore investment transaction, which was the only $100,000 number in the whole case. But that number and that investment had literally nothing to do with Mr. Johnson. The argument that was made to the jury was, well, the $100,000 went to Mr. Dunn, who tried the case, who was here in Chicago, and nobody called to testify. And he was, lo and behold, Mr. Johnson's lawyer. But he wasn't Mr. Johnson's lawyer in his capacity as escrow agent under an escrow agreement when he handled the $100,000. And the $100,000 went offshore. Now, they changed theories, as we've argued in our brief. They have four theories in this case. None of them work. So even on appeal, they try and change theories, which, and I don't think I have to argue that. It's very clear they can't adopt a new theory on appeal, a new legal theory or a new factual theory on appeal. And so they're stuck with their misrepresentation claim. But the factual theories changed. First they say, well, the $100,000 went to Mr. Dunn's law firm, And then it went, and then it went back to Mr. Johnson. They say, well, no, on trial, they said, well, it went to Mr. Pierce offshore, and then he must have sent it back to Mr. Johnson, which they never proved. They just proved there was a lot of money flowing back and forth in various deals, various investment arrangements between Mr. Pierce and Mr. Johnson. And so they surmise, and they asked the jury to simply speculate and surmise that that $100,000 came back. There's no evidence it came back. There's no tracing. There's no nothing.
Who was the check made payable to?
The check was made payable to the law firm of Fetter and Dunn. They cashed it, and they wire transferred. And there's a wire transfer in the record, evidence of the wire transfer in the record. They transferred it to the account of Mr. Pierce. Now, that's the end of any actual tracing. So the plaintiffs then come back with this, well, it must have then been returned in a different form. And they tried to tag, they tried to make Mr. Johnson responsible, somehow responsible, for the disposition of that $100,000. It's if Mr. Dunn and his law firm, who acted as escrow agent, if they'd been a bank, I think you would have had the same argument here. You would have said, well, it's Mr. Johnson's bank. It's Mr. Johnson's lawyer. But the escrow agent was acting as an escrow agent under all of the fiduciary obligations. There's no showing. There is not a whit of evidence in this case that anything improper happened between Mr. Johnson and Mr. Dunn, or that Mr. Dunn did anything wrong, or that Mr. Johnson and Mr. Pierce had anything to do. In fact, one of the great abusive inferences that was tried to be drawn in this case was, like so much in this case, well, we prove it. Why? Because Mr. Johnson can't come up with contrary evidence. The shifting of the burden, constant shifting of the burden in this case, grossly unfair. And he said, well, he can't even remember. He claimed, Mr. Johnson testified, that he sued Mr. Pierce, the offshore guy, and that they were in a fight, in an argument. He said, well, he can't even remember the judge's name. He can't identify the lawsuit. Well, we have. It's right on the federal computer system. It's real. But at trial, because he couldn't come up with the name, he couldn't come up with the papers here in Chicago 4 years ago when the case was tried, there was this inference drawn that everything is phony, that everything's a lie. The problem with this case, Your Honors, is that there is no evidence to support this judgment. There is no rational basis on which the jury could do what they plainly did, which was to hold liability on the offshore investment transactions and then award punitive damages on the basis of the ATM transaction. Let me point something else out to you. There's no evidence anywhere in this record that the ATMs were not in fact sold and delivered. In fact, there's evidence that a year later, Mrs. Kapelansky inquires of the management firm and gets some answers about these various machines. A year later, right before they file suit. There's no evidence that there was any losses for all that this record shows. Let's be clear. Number one, the $100,000 investment may have been made by Mr. Pierce. Nobody knows. Nobody proved it wasn't made. For all this record shows, the ATM machines are still available, could have been sold. There's no evidence as to what the value is. So there's no basis for computing damages that they actually lost anything. Had they gone in and said, look, we're unhappy with the investment, let's sell the machines, for all this record shows, they could have recouped their entire investment in the ATM machines. So what you have is smoke and mirrors. You have a case that was made on smoke and mirrors. You have a case where the burden of proof was effectively shifted by the constant arguing which the court allowed in saying, because the defendant cannot come up with contrary evidence, it must be untrue. That's what you had in this case. There is no threshold evidence in this case of anything. So what you have is, it's as if, I mean, to have the misrepresentation that was claimed, you have to go back to the meeting in Chicago between the Kapelanskis and Mr. Johnson when he was first introduced to them, and Mr. Haskell, who was a friend and acquaintance of the Kapelanskis, who introduced him, and it was Haskell who was actually pushing the offshore investment, not Johnson, who in fact was pushing his own investment and trying to discourage them, which was admitted on this record. You have to go back to there and say, Mr. Johnson committed a fraud at that point. He had to represent something at that point which intentionally, which turned out to be untrue. The only thing he represented was he was going to buy ATM machines and put them in the ATM business. And there's no evidence that he didn't do that. In fact, there's pretty well the record shows that he did do that. He even had to drag Mr. Kapelanski subsequently in February of 99. He had to drag Mr. Kapelanski, Dr. Kapelanski, to, and I see my time is up, to Colorado to meet with the management firm. We don't even know if he hired them, but we do know that a year later, they were still in communication with the management firm. So, Your Honors, we have a verdict here, non-dischargeable in bankruptcy. It's a fraud verdict. It will stay with this man for the rest of his life if it stands, and all we're asking for is a new trial. Give us a fair trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gold.
Just briefly, Your Honors, these transactions, contrary to what Mr. Epstein says, were not two separate and distinct transactions. They all evolved from Mr. Johnson, $400,000 invested by my client with Mr. Johnson took place over a same period of time. Mr. Epstein refers to the ATMs, 10 of the 12. We attempted prior to the actual trial to get documentation as to where these machines were. The record clearly demonstrates that motions to compel orders were entered for production of documents. We were never furnished documents that they were indeed purchased, serial numbers that they were indeed purchased, and all of this evidence was presented to the jury.
Who was responsible for producing those?
I'm sorry?
Was Mr. Johnson or someone else responsible for producing
Mr.
those?
Johnson? Of course, he was the only defendant in the case, and Mr. Johnson, and he's the only defendant in the case, Your Honor.
Well, and he claims...
I'm sorry?
He claims about Pierce and others that were in this.
Well,
is this... You say the record will show strictly that Johnson was the guy that put them into this ATM stuff and this money went to him?
Yeah, this somebody by the name of Pierce, by their own admission, had nothing to do with the ATM machines. He was supposedly an offshore trading outfit. The ATM machines were supposedly purchased with the Kapelanski money by the only defendant in this case, Johnson. It was he who, through discovery, was unable to produce any documentation showing anything in the Kapelanski's names in order to do so. And that evidence was presented to the jury, the failure to produce that. As a matter of fact, the jury, there's no issue in this court about the improper instructions that were given to the jury. And the jury was instructed of the significance and what inferences can be drawn from the failure of a party to produce documents under that party's control.
Now, if there were a return on that so-called investment, would that come through Johnson?
The returns on the... it's a good question. You're talking about the $100,000...
I'm talking about all of it, you say.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they set up the... I think he had his own management company, there were no machines that were, and there were no locations that existed.
So they never got any income from
them? No, they got nothing. They gave this man $400,000+ and got nothing in return. And what the jury heard was they made constant requests, both orally and in writing. They had to do it in writing by fax because their phone calls were not returned, okay? And they never got any information as to where these machines were, where are the serial numbers. That's even in the briefs, I think. You'll see that Mrs. Kapelansky had written faxes.
And of course, the $300,000 that went into the account for the ATM machines is the account from which the defendant withdrew the money to buy the ski house, the condo, and the Mercedes, and all those other things.
Well, certainly that's what evidence the jury heard, mm-hmm. and that's what I argued. And that's what I cross-examined him on. And this is a case where, you know, the jury was properly instructed. They decided what they decided. And I'll be happy to entertain any other questions the court may have.
What is the, as far as the punitive damages are concerned, the way they argue, say, well, $100,000 had to be the offshore investment because that was the $100,000. You would argue differently.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I wasn't in that jury room. You know, I don't know what happened. The instructions, as you can see from the record, were such that they could have awarded $100,000 at some ATM machines. The real issue is whether or not, given the amount of money that was transferred to Mr. Johnston by the Kapelanskys, some $400,000+, and the total award of $100,000 in actual or compensatory and $300,000+ in punitive, as to the punitive issue, whether that number is so outrageous and has no basis in fact in the record. Well, indeed it does, Your Honor. I mean, these people gave him $400,000. How the jury decided how to determine what the punitive should be, I can't answer that. We don't know. I'd love to be in that jury room to find out. But the real question is whether or not that, in accordance with the law of the circuit, that figure of punitive is outrageous. And I obviously, we don't think it is. If there aren't any other questions, I'll sit down. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Anything further, Mr. Epstein?
My distinguished opponent, as authority for the proposition that his clients, the Kapelanskys, never got the information, quite naturally cites his own brief. What he doesn't do, what he can't do, is cite the record. There is no evidence in this record that the Kapelanskys did not receive information, including lists, including serial numbers of the machines, from Mr. Johnston. They were never even asked that question. What is in the record was the fact that Mr. Johnston did not respond to a self-serving letter in, I believe, June of 99, several months after the transactions were completed, in which Mrs. Kapelansky not only requested information on the ATMs, which I, by the way, to clear up a point, counsel is correct, the ATMs were solely Mr. Johnson's investment, had nothing to do with Mr. Pierce. That is correct. But that self-serving letter, which also sought to ask Mr. Johnson about Mr. Pierce's disposition of the $100,000, was unanswered. At that point, of course, we now know that Mr. Johnson was in a fight with Mr. Pierce, which would result in him filing a lawsuit 8 weeks later in the district court in Florida, in the state district court in Florida, in the federal district court in Florida. So he didn't answer that letter. That's the only evidence. We know that a year later, Mrs. Kapelansky was able to contact the managers, and counsel is simply wrong and baseless in suggesting that Mr. Johnson had a management firm. He didn't have a management firm. He had nothing to do with these ATMs after he sold them. And there is evidence that they were sold, that they did exist, that there were locations which were in fact provided to her by third parties.
What is the evidence of that, that these existed and were sold? Does somebody have a receipt or a location or is there something in the record?
In March of right before, 3 months before this suit was filed, it was March of 01, of 2000, I'm sorry, Mrs. Kapelansky got a document, a communication in response to her inquiry to the firm that was managing the machines. They responded. Now, we understand, and we believe that Mr. Johnson testified that before all this, he had given a document to them. He didn't produce it at trial, that's true, but he had given them documentation earlier on. So the only point here is, he can't produce a specific piece of paper at trial, so they say, so the machines don't exist.
Well,
they never testified to that. Nobody did. The only testimony in this record is the machines were there. Other people had listed them. Other people had locations. In fact, there were administrative problems.
Well, let me just get to this, though. The money that they put into the account, you don't dispute that your client used it to buy a ski house in Colorado, a condo, a Mercedes, and all that, and there's nothing in that record that shows that money went to the ATM, to buy the ATMs. You're not disputing that.
Absolutely, I dispute that. And the record also shows that another $600,000 from other sources went into that account. There's no way in God's green acre that anybody can rationally conclude that it was the Kapelansky's money that went to buy the Mercedes as opposed to other monies that went into the same account. That's what you have in this case. Pure prejudice.
Thank you, counsel.
I'm done unless there's another question. Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be taken under advisement. Our next case for argument this morning is...